Well, good evening, everybody. On behalf of the Dean and Chapter, I welcome you very warmly to Westminster Abbey and to this exquisite Lady Chapel, which was finished 501 years ago. The banners you can see are from the Order of the Bath. This is the Chapel of the Order of the Bath. And one's awarded the Order of the Bath for public service. Westminster Abbey Institute was established by Westminster Abbey by the Dean and Chapter to revitalise moral and spiritual values in public service. So, in a sense, what we're doing tonight is bringing what these banners represent to life in our thinking, in our considering. In this spring programme on integrity, we've heard about integrity and the public servant, the individual public servant, about integrity and public service institutions. And tonight we're going to hear about integrity and the public that we serve from Jane Sinclair. Our chair, Jack Straw, will introduce her in a moment. It falls to me simply to welcome, I should say, by the way, I'm Claire Foster-Gilbert, the director of Westminster Abbey Institute, not just some random person. It falls to me to welcome Jack Straw, who is, among many things, a member of the Institute's Council of Reference, and you have his biography on your chairs as well as that of Jane, and you'll see that he held high office and was very much concerned with matters of state for many years. But I can also say, and which is why we've asked him to chair tonight, that he never lost touch with his constituents and he remains loyal to Blackburn still. Jack.
Thank you very much, Claire. I think most people probably did work out who you were and what a profoundly important role you have played, if I may say so, running the Westminster Abbey Institute. I should also, I think, this is in a series of integrity as well as public service, declare an interest, which I hadn't thought of before, but my wife is a member of the Order of the Bath, so there we are. It's a great delight to me to introduce to you the Reverend Jane Sinclair, who's Canon of Westminster. Jane, I'm delighted, honoured, really, to say, is one of the pioneers of the women's ministry. She was one of the first tranche of women ordained as priest in 1994, but she's worked full-time for the Church of England from 1983. She came to it at a very young age. She's now Canon of Westminster. Previously, she's been Archdeacon of Stowe and Lindsay in the Diocese of Lincoln, but before that, she was Vicar of Rotherham, and she's going to talk about serving the general public, mission impossible. And I think all of us who have been in the public service have faced this challenge about how we, as well, we ensure that we do serve the public, but also the public believe that we are serving them rather than simply serving ourselves, which can often be the suspicion, although the reality in my long experience is that most people in public life in Britain, and we're very lucky, are there to serve the public and really do. Over to you, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your welcome. Welcome to Every Town. A Journey into the English Mind is Julian Baggini's 2007 attempt to identify what the dominant philosophy of England is and whether it's sustainable. Baggini aims to make approaches to philosophical thinking accessible to a public generally unfamiliar with formal philosophical methodology. But in order to research his book, Baggini recognised that he needed to look beyond the facts and figures provided by the ever-increasing number of opinion polls, and instead to engage with the people whose thoughts these polls described. But where could Baggini go to find out what the typical English person thinks? Where was the place that contained what Baggini describes as all types of the English? The answer turned out to be a large section of Rotherham. In 2005, Rotherham had the postcode area with the closest match of household types to the country as a whole. S66 had the most typical mix of wealthy pensioners, struggling families, aspiring singles, and so on, with a 93% match to the national data set. The neighbouring postcode area of S25 was the fourth closest match to the national data set. Bergini had found his every town. In the prologue to his book, Bergini lists some of the values and characteristics of Rotherham which he expected to find there, making no attempt to mask his prejudices. The list was drawn up before he moved to Rotherham for his research proper, and I quote, "I thought there would be toleration for difference, but no real love for it, and only as long as it was perceived not to be threatening. There would be provincialism. People's aspirations would be modest, or else for superficial things like fame or wealth. The best life would be comfortable and fun. People would think religion was for weirdos and philosophy for boffins. Anti-intellectualism would be rife. People would have their philosophies of life, which would be simple but true. Be thankful for what you've got. Make the most of what you have. Time waits for no man. Although in behaviour most people would be sexually liberal, most still would want to be married and think that children deserve two married parents. There would be a thin line between having some youthful fun and being a slag. Homophobia would be normal. Despite the talk of a national culinary renaissance, people would still eat badly and the best restaurant around would be rubbish. People would have several fears, which are not just founded in their actual experience. Crime, the youth of today, and so forth, would worry people, even though S66 is probably a fairly quiet area. There would be cynicism, especially about politicians. They would say the television is full of trash, but they'd still watch it all the time. They would have a sense of who they were and what their kind were and would be keen to differentiate themselves. The much heralded decline of identity would turn out to be overstated. But overall, most people would be pleasant and decent." Bergini reflects on his list 2 years later, after his research is complete. He says this, "Three things strike me. The first is how critical and condescending a lot of it sounds. The second, nonetheless, how little turned out to be totally wide of the mark." He makes the point that a caricature of the truth may still be true, but does not necessarily go deep enough. You have a first impression on meeting someone. They are boisterous, extrovert, witty, yet apparently unreflective. But on deeper acquaintance, you may discover an inner sensitivity, a desire to be understood, a longing for personal meaning and purpose. The first impression is still true, but it's not the whole truth, as Bergini found in his work in Rotherham. The third observation which he makes is that his list of characteristics, while largely true of the area of Rotherham, the Rotherham he engaged with, does not really reveal anything about national philosophy of Englishness. Rotherham is, finally, Rotherham. It is not Dover or Glasgow or Larne or Llandudno, nor is it the hamlets of Swaledale, Bodmin Moor or the Lincolnshire Wolds. Now, Rotherham has been through very tough times over the past 30 years. But that said, it is a place of great potential, with a gritty, no-nonsense and proud population, most of whom long for and work hard to see the place thriving once again. And I know the town well and love its people. I was the vicar there for just over 4 years at the time when Bergini was doing his research. And I've been deeply saddened to follow the appalling stories of abuse that have emerged from Rotherham in the years since I left. Sadly, these stories of abuse appear not to be peculiar to Rotherham, rather perhaps an indicator of Rotherham's typicality as an exemplar of some English community life, or community life in England. Now, I've cited Bergini at length simply to make the point that describing tightly what might be termed the general public is a minefield and pretty much doomed to failure from the outset. Ask anyone who is the general public, and you're likely to receive an answer along the lines of, the general public are people like me. But me, of course, is not you, or her, or them. Individually and in all sorts of different groupings and networks and interest groups, everyone resident in the UK forms what might be called the general public. And even then, of course, we must add those who are visiting the UK at any one time and those who are UK citizens but are abroad for a variety of reasons, and so on. For the purposes of this lecture, I'm working on the premise that the general public is, broadly speaking, all those who are resident in the UK today, of whatever age, nationality, background, political persuasion, or any other category you choose to name. UK residence is my yardstick. Now, those of you who are civil servants, politicians, or are involved in any sort of public service, voluntary or paid, will recognize the challenges. Not surprisingly, serving the general public takes on many different guises. Take some of our large public institutions. I've just chosen three: Parliament, the National Health Service, the Church of England. All are charged with serving the general public of the UK, or in the case of the Church of England, the general public of England. How do they set about fulfilling their brief? Well, the Westminster Parliament is constitutionally at the centre of all national lawmaking. Its legitimacy as the legislature which can and should create law for the whole general public of the UK lies in its democratic credentials. All members of Parliament are elected by those eligible and registered to vote in the UK. But the role of elected MPs, and alongside it the work of the members of the House of Lords, is tied in with some considerable subtlety to the role of the head of state, the monarch, and to the UK's independent judiciary. Elected MPs have the responsibility of ensuring that the local concerns of their constituency are adequately represented within the larger national concerns of Parliament as a whole, and that national priorities are properly represented back to their constituencies. That's amongst their many other pieces of work that MPs have to do. Devolved government in Scotland, and to a lesser extent in Wales and Northern Ireland, has sought to give regional responsibility in carefully defined areas of tax and expenditure, and some other policy areas. In other words, it's recognised that a working balance has to be found to enable the national legislature to act for the whole of the UK population in areas of activity where the national interest is at stake, say in defence policy or international relations, and other areas of concern which might reasonably be dealt with at a more local level, say, in social care provision. All of this is caught up within long-standing and still evolving British constitutional custom and practice, unwritten and complex as it is. The NHS is similarly challenged. How should it provide fair access to the best quality of healthcare across the whole of the UK, bearing in mind the limited resources available and the ever-growing expectations of the population? The answer is very much a work in progress, and not an easy work in progress at that. Where should specialist hospitals or clinics be sited? How can we best ensure access to good quality healthcare for those who do not live in urban areas and where public transport is difficult? And so on. You'll know the questions. What is often depicted as an intractable problem for the NHS is, in fact, a challenge to all of us. Are we prepared to pay for the health service we want? If not, who is to make the decisions about where resources should be focused and on what grounds are the decisions to be made? What priorities should the most vulnerable in society have in calls upon NHS resources? Who are the most vulnerable? Who should decide who they are? And on what grounds? Should decisions be made nationally or locally? The Church of England is the public institution which I know best. As the established church, it has always made itself available to every resident in England. Every inch of the country, barring royal peculiars like Westminster Abbey, falls within a Church of England parish. And every parish resident, no matter what their beliefs or lack of them, has the right to be baptized and to be married in their parish church. From Middlesbrough to Huish Episcopi, the Church of England has ordained and lay people on the ground, living and working alongside local residents. The parish clergy can claim with some credibility to know who the general public are in their patch. The downside is that it is notoriously difficult to get the Church of England as a whole to act nationally. The General Synod, the House of Bishops, the Archbishops all can claim to speak for the Church of England and the public whom it serves, but none necessarily does so in practice, whatever the press may like to think. What happens in any parish may bear little relationship to what the National Church proclaims as Church of England policy. And I speak as a former archdeacon. Of course, there are thousands of other national organisations and networks which serve the general public. Major retail chains, large service industries, including banks and building societies, leisure and sports organisations, cultural organisations, and the major voluntary sector organisations, amongst others. But the difference between most of these organisations and those I outlined earlier is that they are in a position to choose which parts of the public with which they wish to engage. Those in the business of manufacturing and selling goods will identify their market and ignore others. They are engaged in making a profit for their shareholders. Charities, who are not in the business of making profits, focus their work on the section of the public they wish to serve. But those charities will be equally focused on fundraising from a wider but nonetheless carefully defined tranche of grant-giving organisations, as well, for some of them at least, as the general public as a whole. So, to sum up, to understand what is meant by the general public, you need not only to understand the general concept of general public and its complexities, you need also to understand the standpoint of the person describing the general public which they're serving, describing, or engaging with. I want to move now to explore briefly two areas of public service engagement with the general public, which may help to identify some of the drivers which shape the success or lack of success of this public service engagement. And I'm indebted particularly to Professors Graham Smith and J.A. Chandler, on some of whose work I'm going to draw. In his book, Public Policy and Private Interest, just recently published, Professor Chandler explores the complexities of public policy-making processes. This is the stuff of everyday life for civil servants and politicians. It's the major means by which service of the general public is experienced day by day. As Chandler comments, the importance of any public policy is, for most citizens, not primarily how it is made, but the consequences of its content to them as individuals. Hence, the instant analysis of any budget tax proposal by financial experts in terms of the cost benefit it will make to the individual and to his or her family. Chandler goes on to argue that the content of public policy in the UK is a reflection of a combination of ideological and ethical values and self-interest, a result of compromises made within groups rather than by a single individual. And this is only to be expected, given the number of people who must be consulted and convinced of a public policy case in the UK polity for it to be implemented effectively. The result can be that the interests of the general public, or of a section of the general public, can sometimes take second place to the horse trading of policymakers. Compare Yes Minister to the machinations of Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel. Yes Minister may be slightly more contemporary and funnier than the fictionalised Machiavellian power play of the Tudor court, but both forms of storytelling speak truthfully, to a degree, of power play at work in public policy making. It was Thomas Hobbes who coined the famous phrase, "No arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Without civilizing institutions, chaos will ensue, argues Hobbes out of his experience of the English Civil War. One definition of effective public policy is that it is a means by which the general public are protected from what would otherwise be the chaos of natural events and the unintended accidents that result from uncoordinated and self-interested human actions. A more positive approach would be to argue that effective policymaking is a way of serving the general public by the promotion of goodness, enabling groups and human society as a whole to flourish. Chandler uses the example that compares termites. Termites can make wonderful termite hills because of their superb biological programming, but they, as far as we know, are not aware of goodness as such. We humans are capable of identifying values which are important to us and shaping our behavior accordingly, whether as individuals or even as a society. At its best, public policy can be shaped from cooperation as well as from the struggles and compromises between self-conscious individuals with very different ideas about what is important to them and to others. Now, when public policy is seen to be hijacked by a particular interest group or is seen to be unfair and unjust, there will almost inevitably be trouble. Challenges in the courts, vilification in the press, and at worst, riots on the streets. You have only to recall the disastrous proposals to implement a poll tax in 1989 in Scotland and 1990 in England, or more recently, the so-called bedroom tax, to see what can go wrong when public policy is perceived to be fundamentally unfair and unjust. If public policy at its best is to do with enabling human flourishing, it's important that those who form and implement public policy have a deep understanding of how we as individuals conduct our lives and how we ought to behave as humans. Human beings are not ultimately statistics or constituencies or networks or focus groups or whatever. Members of the general public are people who are shaped by their cultures and values, who have aspirations for themselves and for others, who make mistakes and pick themselves up again, who are moral and spiritual beings, and who long for purpose and fulfillment in their lives. The moral and ethical dimensions of how individuals and groups should behave are important to all of us, whether we're conscious of this or not. Public policy needs to be properly informed by these issues and priorities, not simply devised to suit economic or party political or whatever needs and aspirations. Of course, there will be differences of opinion between members of the general public about the moral and ethical dimensions of our lives, but this should be the subject of debate and engagement in policymaking. How diverse and inclusive a society do we wish to be? Should we be? What value do we put on the life of a migrant seeking help from the UK? On what moral grounds should some people in society pay less tax than others? Well, I've barely scratched the surface of the complex issues bound up in the formation and implementation of public policy as a means of serving the general public. But I'm going to turn from public policy to public participation in democratic processes as a way of helping us explore these issues in a slightly different context. Professor Graham Smith is best known for his work on public participation in democratic processes. In his seminal book, Democratic Innovations, Smith explores some alternative forms of democratic engagement, that's an alternative to what we presently have, some alternative forms of democratic engagement as a possible means of increasing the participation of a much wider range of citizens in political decision-making. Smith outlines the evidence of public disillusionment with the institutions of advanced industrial democracies. Numbers of those voting in local and general elections indicate a gradual decline over many years in electoral turnout. Opinion polls indicate continuing low levels of trust in politicians and political institutions. Now, Smith wrote this particular book in 2009, but the Veracity Index, published by Ipsos Mori for 2015, still indicates that government ministers and politicians, I'm sorry about this, Jack, government ministers and politicians are the least trusted to tell the truth of all the professions, bumping along at 21 or 22 percentage points. Even estate agents come in at 25%, better than politicians. I ought to perhaps add that civil servants come in at 59% trust rating and clergy at 67%. All are outclassed by hairdressers at 69%. And to our relief, best of all, doctors at 89%. Well, writing prior to the significant changes in the membership of the Labour Party during 2016, Smith goes on to comment that generally there's been a decline in the membership of traditional mobilising organisations, such as political parties and trade unions. The challenges which disconnection then poses can be severe and self-perpetuating. When policies are worked out for rather than with a politically excluded constituency, they are unlikely to engage all relevant concerns. That's Anne Phillips' comment from her book, The Politics of Presence. Smith has commented much more recently that perhaps this was reflected in the Brexit vote. If the Brexit result tells us anything, it is that large parts of the population feel alienated from the political process. Opening up new forms of political participation to hear the voices of the politically marginalised is thus critical for the well-being of our polity, he argues. So Smith says, a growing disconnection between citizens and decision-makers does not mean that citizens are necessarily less committed to democratic norms and values. He's undertaken two pilots or experiments in democratic innovation which demonstrate this. Assembly North, held in Sheffield, and Assembly South, held in Southampton, were two citizens' assemblies held as part of the Democracies Matter project. The assemblies were held in October 2015 and differed slightly from one another. Assembly North was a classic citizen-only model. Assembly South was mixed with a proportion of local politicians alongside citizens. Those who took part in these assemblies were asked to reflect on the experience. Now, they were, I don't need to go into what they were debating, but they were debating matters of importance to them. But they were asked to reflect on actually taking part in this assembly experience. And from their responses and the very fact that they were prepared to take part in the enterprise at the outset and give up weekends in order to do this, Smith argues that given the opportunity to participate in significant decision-making, otherwise unengaged UK citizens are very prepared to step up. Well, it's a tiny example. Maybe it's not replicable. Who knows? But that's what he's arguing. So democratic innovations such as these may prove to be one means of addressing the aspects of the UK democracy which have been weakened or are failing for whatever reason. Perhaps there's overcomplexity of process leading to a lack of transparency and popular control. Political or other pressures leading to a lack of considered judgment, maybe, in our legislative processes. Or a public perception that significant decision-making is for a political elite alone, leading to a lack of perceived inclusivity. Just as in the formation of public policy, the means by which the general public is enabled to participate in democratic processes in the UK have moral and ethical implications. Meaningful participation in the democratic process, a sense that it's worth voicing opinions and questions, that as citizens we are interdependent, and that our future is bound up with the well-being of our neighbours, these are key to the maintenance of a healthy democracy. We should not be embarrassed to say that we are all our brother's or sister's keeper. This is a moral and ethical imperative. It should mean that we are concerned to ensure that the marginalised and those whose voices are often drowned out in the melee of political and cultural celebrity, the marginalised are given a voice and listened to, carefully. It should mean that we celebrate diversity amongst the general public and seek to recognise it as a strength in our public life, not a threat or a weakness. It should mean that we can sometimes question nationally, regionally, or locally whether the majority wish is necessarily the right wish. At least ask the question. How can our democratic processes better inform, reflect, and enable the creation of a good, generous, and caring society, one that seeks to curb our human tendency to cause harm to others and promotes instead the common good? Now, I know many of you are committed to that cause, and I'll be interested to hear your comments and questions shortly. What is striking about these areas of public policy development and democratic innovation is that their success, or lack of it, appears to be shaped by some basic underlying drivers. Drivers which, when they are in place, help to build the public confidence necessary for the life of society as a whole to flourish. I'm going to stick my neck out and try and identify three drivers this evening. There are doubtless many more. The first of these is trust. Trust between political decision makers and the electorate. Trust between citizens themselves. Trust between those who create public policy and those who must live within its bounds. The existence of trust does not mean that accountability should be treated lightly. We are fallible, and proper accountability is a means of ensuring that mutual trust is well-founded and secure. Well-founded trust enables sufficient belief in the democratic process for that process to work well, including all who wish to participate in it, with transparency of process and the resources needed for the considered judgment that it takes to make good law. A good degree of trust can also enable public policy to be developed with proper respect towards those whom it will impact, and with confidence that any difficulties which are encountered will be voiced, listened to, and dealt with properly and efficiently. But the trust of the general public in a political or civil service elite cannot be assumed. There is plenty of evidence that a lack of trust leads to an unwillingness to participate, suspicion of the motives and processes used by those in public service, and a tendency to treat lightly those policies of which an individual or a community finds unwelcome. The undermining of trust in public institutions and in those who work in them can be deeply corrosive of the public good. That is why the Daily Mail's pre-Christmas headline damning High Court judges as enemies of the people was, in my view, outrageous. By all means, be critical of judicial decisions, but beware the damage you do if you seek to undermine public trust in an independent judiciary per se. The second driver underlying the success of public policy and democratic innovation is that of, and I've got to the word at last, integrity. As Claire reminded us last week, integrity essentially means oneness or wholeness. It encompasses such qualities as honesty, transparency, and consistency. To be a person or an institution with integrity means that you will seek to act for the greater good of the whole and not out of mere self-interest. You will, in terms of today's lecture, seek the flourishing of the general public. It means that you, individually or as an institution, are worthy of the public's trust and respect. Acting with integrity will, in fact, help to build public trust. You will take a long and wide and carefully considered view before advocating policy. You will actively seek out diverse opinion, to listen, to test ideas, to seek wisdom and truth beyond your own or beyond that of your peer group. Vernon White reminded us earlier in this lecture series, with integrity, you will be prepared to steer the taxing course between the blind application of principle or political dogma and an unprincipled and possibly inconsistent appeal to personal conscience alone. The third driver, which is related to trust and integrity, is that of hope. In order to enter into the trustful relationships needed to make a democratic society work, and in order to develop effective public policy, the general public and those who serve it need to believe that the whole project is worth their time and effort. That is, It is hopeful work in which they are engaged. There is no point in devising a new policy for tax or reforming the NHS or even opening a new church if it is not intended to bear fruit for the greater good. The hope cannot simply be the wishful thinking of the few. To bear fruit, the hope has to be genuinely held and worked for by those for whose benefit it is given. To ask ourselves of any public policy under discussion or any change to our democratic process, how does this embody real, life-transforming hope for the future? To ask the public to imagine what that hopeful future might look like, that is to begin to help the public own the purpose, the goal of our life together. Now, there are doubtless other drivers that might be named. Trust, integrity, and hopefulness are just three of whose importance I've become aware as I've been preparing this talk. Integral to the importance of all three in public life is that trust, integrity, and hopefulness need to be named and shared as public values, unashamedly and robustly. Wouldn't it be good, I know you would agree with this, wouldn't it be good to be able to move away from public policy as damage limitation and more towards public policy as promoting all that makes for human flourishing? Wouldn't it be good to have democratic processes which everyone is proud of and pleased to be engaged with, which are seen to deliver democratic goods for all to enjoy? So, is the service of the general public a mission impossible? No, it is not an impossible mission, but it is a very demanding one and is always going to be a work in progress, needing transparency, mutual respect, truthfulness, with our energies focused on building mutual trust and a high degree of personal and public integrity. We've come a long way from Rotherham in 2007, and the town has been through the mill since then, very publicly and painfully. Not all is perfect now, I'm told. But at least the government commissioners have been working effectively, and the control of some government of council functions is beginning to be handed back to local people. The courage of a whistleblower brought the abuse scandal to public attention, such that action had to be taken. The ensuing public spotlight brought all sorts of other failings to light in terms of wider local government practice and public policy failure. Heads have rolled, and there has been much heart-searching among Rotherham residents. But there are signs now of the beginning of the rebuilding of trust, a recognition of the importance of personal and public integrity, and the early growth of new hope, I think, among the public who I know in Rotherham. And what can be true of Rotherham, I believe, can be true of us all. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Jane. That was terrific. We now come to questions, and if you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand. I just make one observation, if I may, which is about this issue of trust, which I think exercises anybody who's held any elective office, as I did for a very long time. And there are two things to say about it. One is that, yes, we're down with the estate agents. Now, we always have been. it's a toss-up as whether they're a point above us or we're a point above them. In 1944, when Gallup first started polling, it discovered, this is in the year before he quotes won the war, when things were actually, there was lots more hope around than there had been a couple of years before that. Politicians had a dreadful reputation, and they were not trusted. So I think it's probably got slightly worse, but not so much worse. The second thing, which I was always very struck by, and I'm sure this is something which any clergyman or clergywoman will be well aware of, is that people may have a sense of scorn or derision for an institution in general and be ready to damn a breed, clergy or politicians. But then if they get to know you, they will make the exception. And that, I think, is one of the ways we should take hope. Because if the more that you, in any of these positions, you're ready to make yourself available and to become known, the more trust you'll get back. A question. Who would like to ask a question, please? Yes. I happen to know this young man. It's called Daniel Whiteley. I'm not going to explain why.
Thank you.
What? Would you stand up there, please, Daniel? Sure.
Should serving the public be seen as a proactive or a reactive endeavour? Is it giving the public what they need or what a public servant thinks they need?
Well, it's bound to be both reactive. Well, it's certainly bound to be, to a degree, reactive. It's going to be an interrelationship, isn't there, between reactive and proactive? Because events happen and you have to deal with them. But equally, there are opportunities for politicians to be proactive. David Cameron, for all sorts of reasons, felt the need to call a referendum. So he did. That was a sort of proactive action for all sorts of reasons. He felt he needed to call one. The event happened. Now we're having to deal with a reaction. I mean, we're having to then deal with what the results are. And some of how we deal with that may be proactive, but some of it may be... is going to necessarily have to take account of the reaction to that. So I think both are true. It was a question of do we give what the public need or what we wish to give them? Was that something? What a public servant thinks. I'd be very interested to know what some of you out here think the answer to that question is, because I think the public perception is that, if I just give an example, when I was in Rotherham, the public perception was that the kind of stuff that we were getting back from London when we were trying to get major grants in to help regeneration and whatnot, was that they were just giving us what they thought they wanted to give us and not really listening to Rotherham people at all. I see another side of the coin down here. But that's exactly where the dilemma lies. How do civil servants listen really carefully, and how can the public make sure that they articulate really carefully what they think they need? And what they think they need is only going to be in their narrow thing. They're not necessarily going to have the wider vision, which hopefully a civil servant will. So there's going to have to be, it's how you get that interrelationship going.
Thank you. Yes, sir, if you could stand up too, please, and maybe say who you are as well.
My name is Aaron Roseland. Thank you very much for your talk. It was excellent, and I will poorly paraphrase something that you said, which was integrity is acting in the interests of the public, not in self-interest, so to speak. This assumes that self-interest is a negative thing and the public interest is a positive thing. But what happens when one is asked to act in a way that benefits the public interest or for the benefit of the team, if you're at work, which contravenes your personal interest, beliefs, ideals, or integrity?
Yes, and I've spoken to many people, I've listened to many people recently who've been struggling with just that over the road in relation to their own beliefs and then what they're having to actually, political beliefs, what they're actually having to struggle with over there. And I think that's very, very difficult. I mean, where we go with that is, well, how do you, first of all, clarify what the choices are, if there are choices, and then be honest with yourself and with others about why you're having to make particular decisions you are. An extreme example, I suppose, I don't know if it's an exact comparison, actually. Well, it isn't. But an extreme example is something like Dietrich Bonhoeffer during the Second World War, Lutheran pastor, completely against Hitler and Nazism and so on. Should he be involved in a plot to assassinate Hitler? And as a Christian, no, he shouldn't. Integrity as a Christian, he shouldn't. But in the end, he argues himself in a position where he does get involved in this plot. He doesn't succeed, of course, and he gets imprisoned and killed as a result. But he's had to struggle with his putting, kind of how you weigh up, I suppose in his case, he was weighing up public interest versus his own self, his own actual beliefs, core beliefs, vocation, and in the end chose to sacrifice that for what he thought was the greater good. Oh, you could go the other way, I suppose, but sorry, that's a slightly incoherent response.
I wasn't incoherent at all, but anyway. yes, sir, please.
Thank you. So, John Fitzpatrick, I'm a civil servant, and I was really interested in some of the things you were saying about trust and integrity in public servants. It made me think that elected public servants, given the very visible and public role they have, probably have a bigger role to play than maybe many other public servants in building and upholding that trust. And it just made me think about whether trust is a calling that lasts, well, you know, trust in public service is a calling that lasts all your life, or actually it's something that people have within their career, but then sometimes act differently beyond their public service career. So my question was, you know, how damaging do you think it is, for example, for elected public servants to, for example, generate extreme personal wealth after their politicians, for example, on the back of the public work they do as MPs, for example?
I'm not going to be commenting on any particular examples. and there are rules. There's guidance, obviously, on this about what you can and can't do. Personally, I'm just going to give a personal opinion here. Personally, I find that quite hard. I understand why it happens, but I do find it quite hard because you're in effect profiting from public service that other people have elected you to do, sometimes beyond, you know, I suppose if I would hope that if I was in that position, I would have the generosity of heart, if I was earning a lot of money, to be able to be very generous and make sure that what I was earning went to public good and so on. But I think it's quite difficult in terms of public perception. I think that is quite difficult for the general public to understand. They would simply understand it as self-interest. I don't know what other people... I mean, I don't know whether any politicians here or anybody else would like to comment on that.
What, as a lapsed politician? I think there's a balance here. I think that... I speak personally. If you are in British politics, you're certainly not doing it to make money. And that's very sharp distinction between British politics and some continental politics and many other systems where people who are in politics make a lot of money out of it. And although we have low trust ratings, I think instinctively the public understand that. I think, for example, when I, for the last 4.5 years that I wasn't on the front bench, I earned some money from advisory work and some from writing. And I did it in my spare time. I thought that was reasonable. I think it's just it's a matter of proportion. Let me say, most members of Parliament, when they finish, don't make any money at all. It's only those who've been lucky enough, as I was and some others were, to have had some experience, normally of quite high ministerial office, who will have any opportunity to earn anything. So and I think for us, it is very much a matter of proportion. In general, I think my compatriots get it right. One or two sometimes don't quite get it right.
And Jack, could I just add that certainly since I've been working down in Westminster, which is about 2.5 years now, and I've got to know MPs and members of the House of Lords, 99.9%, if we're 100, are really hard-working, committed public servants. The sort of public perception of they're in it for the money or they're in it just for their own celebrity or something just isn't true. Mm. And it probably takes people like, not just me, because I'm in a pulpit now and again, but the rest of us need to say that, actually, as part of saying, look, actually, it is possible to have a proper degree of trust in these people who we've elected to work on our behalf. And they're under huge pressures, impossible kind of workloads and impossible choices they're having to make. They need our support, and I would say prayer, actually, not just to be knocked. You've heard me say that.
No, I think, yeah. Yes, sir, please.
My name's Chris Hyder. You ably articulated that the UK citizen is disenfranchised to a degree. And underpinning integrity, hope, and trust was the need for transparency. But I wonder, do you also think there's a need for transformation in how we engage democratically with the UK citizen?
So do I think that Smith, or there may be other examples of kind of innovative ways of engaging with it. I think those experiments well worth trying, actually. The political difficulty, of course, is that it's a little bit like opening Pandora's box, and you're not quite sure what the end result's going to be. And are you simply saying ever more? It's not just going to be Yorkshire wanting independence, but Rotherham wanting independence, or whatever. And you get terrible kind of disunity, if I can put it that way. But at the moment, this country's got a very long and honourable tradition of evolution in terms of its democratic processes, and I think it would be well worth, personally, I think it would be worth trying some more of this and seeing where we get to. It clearly has been quite effective where this sort of local assembly has been held.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Amir and I'm from Casual Politics. In regard to politicians who are committed public servants, don't you think that this is the perception of politicians that we've been given by the media, which is wrong? For instance, when Jo Cox, she was savagely murdered last year, and people got to know her better and to know that she sacrificed herself for her constituents and for the public, in general. So don't you think that we get to know politicians as individuals rather than whether or not they're politicians? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that rather echoes a bit what Jack was saying. If you do get the chance to get to know your MP or your MEP, whoever it is, take that opportunity. They're people too and have got their own ethical frameworks and aspirations and so on. The murder of Jo Cox was a kind of flashbulb moment, wasn't it, in terms of people realising that politics is a costly business, literally cost her life. Of course, you then get all the kind of... I didn't know Jo Cox when she was alive, but you got a lot of what happened afterwards, where she became a sort of martyr. But by all accounts, a very committed and good public servant. I think what we can do as individuals is to get to know MPs or our politicians and then engage with them in a constructive way. It's not wrong for the press to be critical or to ask critical questions, but it is wrong if we just go along with sort of stereotyping. And we can avoid that. We've got it in our power to do that. There are surgeries every week with MPs, for example.
Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you very much for an excellent talk. My name's Sarah Walsh. I'm a hospital consultant, so I'm a doctor. And pleased but increasingly surprised to find us at the top of the public trust hit parade. But obviously, public trust in my profession, I would say, was considerably undermined by people like Harold Shipman. And in the wake of that, we have had a process imposed upon us called revalidation, which leads to the award of a license to practice, which is now, you know, a legal requirement for me to do my job. And as part of that revalidation process, I'm obliged in a 5-year cycle to demonstrate that I am maintaining the trust of the general public. And I think my question is, do you think that onus should be upon all people who serve the public to demonstrate on a cyclical basis that they are maintaining the trust of that public?
That's very... Can I just ask you, before I try and answer the question, how do you demonstrate that trust?
By means of a portfolio. So you are asked to produce evidence, which would include formalised feedback from your patients, formalised feedback from colleagues delivered in an anonymised fashion, evidence that you had participated in training and how to give good service to patients. You're allowed to draw evidence from a number of different sources, evidence that you're writing guidelines, for example, to ensure that patients get a high standard of care. So there's various ways in which it's done.
That's fascinating. And it does happen, I think, well, here I am thinking, I'm thinking to myself, it would be interesting to ask my congregation to tell me whether they trust me. I think that's quite good practice, actually, to attend. I mean, whether it has to be done in quite such detail or how it's done. I mean, but as a principle, I think that's quite good practice myself. The danger is it becomes a tick box exercise. So you don't want to do it so often it becomes a tick box exercise. But from time to time, to be able to take that temperature might be very useful for those of us involved in public service type work.
Yes, madam, there. Thank you. Just here at the front, the lady in blue, waving. Good.
Thank you. I'm Carol Burry, and come July, I will have worked for what is now called the Ministry of Justice for 43 years. We run all of the courts and prisons in England and Wales, and I was wondering if you could think of a suggestion for me getting my customers to tick the box to say how happy they are with how I've provided the service to them.
Who would you say your customers are? Those...
Well, we run all of the courts in England and Wales and all of the prisons in England and Wales, so therefore anyone who's needed to appear in a court or has been compelled to appear in a court or who is currently a guest of Her Majesty.
Yes, that'd be interesting. So how to ask them to do that. I'll have to have a think about that. I don't know if I know the answer. Has anybody else got a suggestion they like to make? Yes.
In the front. Yes, I mean, I worked for about 20 years in the Magistrates' Court Service, when it was called the Inner London Magistrates' Court Service, and in court. Of course, most people didn't want to be there, but I did find that if at the end of a long morning of dealing with many, 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 many cases, people felt that they'd been listened to, that they did go away feeling that they were satisfied with the treatment they'd received, if you like, and no, we didn't think of them as customers, but if they were treated with courtesy and were dealt with in a fair way, that is to say, you weren't treated worse because you had a funny name that people couldn't pronounce, you know, but you asked them, how do you want your name pronouncing? Just things like that, that you could see that everyone was being listened to, given time, treated with respect, that actually you did get the feeling that people were not dissatisfied, even though, of course, nobody liked being appearing in front of a court, being charged with criminal offences. So I think that, in fact, I mean, the good old criteria of treating people with respect and with not uniformity, but consistency, actually do go a long way to providing the sort of satisfaction that our friend here is talking about.
Okay. Yeah. So living out the values you hopefully espouse. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Other questions? Gentleman at the back, please.
Thank you, Piers. I'm a civil servant. We've heard this evening about serving the general public and the people who do that, such as politicians, doctors, clergy, and civil servants. But do we, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, when we talk about serving the general public, take away a sense of responsibility from the general public in terms of public service, and how can we instill in every single member of the public a real sense of public service so it isn't just public servants who serve?
I can only speak from my own experience, I think, here. I don't have a kind of, you know, master plan or something, but my own experience is that If I'm out, you know, when I've been a vicar or something, I've been out and about. If I go and visit people and I listen to them and I engage with them, actually, on the whole, most people do actually want to. I was going to say be good. That I don't quite mean that, but they actually they care for their neighbour, one way or the other. I mean, some people don't, but most people have that in them. And I don't just engage with church people if I'm out and about. Anybody. And to be able to say to them, and it's sometimes simply about articulating, this is what you're doing, you know. You're already, oh, great, you're going and visiting Mrs. Bloggs, who's, you know, needs the shopping taken to her. What a fantastic, you know, how good for you to care for her, that's fantastic. Now, actually, that's public service, at a very kind of, but a minor but very important level, because that's what Mrs. Smith needs. So it's something about actually helping helping people to articulate what it is they're realizing that what they're doing is public service and encouraging it. I don't have a blanket. I mean, I don't think it would work, you know, for somebody in Parliament to say, come on, we've all got to get the general public into public service. It's much more about working one-to-one or in small groups and saying, what can we do? If I just... I'll give you one other example. It's a Rotherham one, but it could be from anywhere. The parish that I was engaged with had a very... There are a number of big estates around Rotherham. I had a particularly challenging estate in my patch. And I used to manage, amongst other things, a small project that helped people with young teenage moms, particularly with parenting skills. And the way what we discovered was, what was needed was that a lot of the fences around the little gardens that were attached to the houses there had been pulled down or damaged or destroyed. It was all very kind of run down. So we bought some equipment and got a couple of the people in the project were blokes, and we got them to go onto the estate and to start rebuilding fences, because it meant then that people could let the children out to play safely, small children out to play safely in a green space. Well, the other blokes on the estate thought this was they could see the point of this, some of the dads, and so they all started joining in, and they chipped in together, and we got them a grant or two, and we got some more. And it didn't transform the whole estate, but it began to, and was, to my mind, a good example of how just on the ground you can begin to do that. Now, I don't think you can that's not the sort of thing you can really legislate for, but it is something that individually we can in our own communities encourage. So I suppose I'm thinking small is sometimes very beautiful and very effective.
Thank you. I think I just checked whether... I think you've asked one question already, sir, so I'll just take... but if I may, I'll take from... there's a gentleman just behind you. If there's time, I'll call you. And then there's a gentleman here. thank you.
Thank you. My name is David Edmondson. I'm a civil servant. One of the things that I struggle with a little bit at the moment is what I would call the integrity of the debate that's in the public realm. If I take one example, can we afford the social care? The big question in the news at the moment, do we choose to afford the social care? And if we do choose to afford that social care, then what does it mean for me as an individual or somebody else as an individual who has to pay for it going in the future? I think at the moment, from my point of view, we're avoiding that debate. We see one side of the argument. We see the social side. We see the human side. We avoid the other side of that argument. Both of you will have been in situations where you stand in front of an individual or 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 individuals. I wonder if you could give an example or two from your experiences of how you prepare yourselves for knowing that you've got to be honest and show integrity in the debate when every part of you simply wants to say yes to the individual person that you next meet.
All right, go on, I'll go first and you can think about the answer. I think that there's always a temptation, particularly for politicians, to tell people what you think they want to hear, and to try and glide over the difficulties. But in fact, it's a hopeless strategy. And my long experience, I mean, particularly with, well, I was summoned to appear in the House of Commons as a minister when something had gone wrong, or badly wrong, and you had to own up to it, was just to get the whole lot out. I mean, just, you know, the whole lot. And then you've said it, and it might, you know, it's not comfortable. You may open the newspapers the following day and find there are questions about your parentage that you never realised, and much else besides. Wonder why your children even talk to you. But you get through that. But that's far better than kind of dodging around the issue. And I think it just aggravates people, because they get, in the end, people can see through these things. Tempting, but I think the alternative is just... I always used to tell colleagues that if they had something Remember, the safest things to do is to march towards the sound of gunfire. Just put it all out, or try and tell the public. And in the long run, you do better that way.
I'd agree with you. I agree with you there, Jack, that it's about being honest, and it's about showing respect to the public. They're big and grown up, you know, they can take it, kind of thing. You know, there's no point in pussyfooting around. So, I've not had to deal with it on the kind of scale that you know, Jack has or politicians have, but sometimes if you've just got to say, well, this is how it looks, this is the reality check, this is actually how it looks. Now can we talk about it and just see where together we might go from here? And I've done that. I've had to do that with families. I've had to do it with congregations. And actually, on the it can be uncomfortable, but on the whole, once you're putting a corporate mind to it, you can work out some way forward. That doesn't give you a solution to the whole social care issue that the country might be facing at the moment. But I do think that we need to not be frightened. I think we just have to be honest with the general public. I don't see why not. And if it means that it's going to take some doing to make sure that the press and everybody else report it as reasonably accurately, well, it's going to take that effort. There's no shortcuts to that.
Another question? Yes, please.
My name is Adam Bayliss-West. I'm a civil servant. I suppose my question, in a sense, is perhaps the reverse side of the question that was asked by the gentleman behind me. And I was struck by the idea of the general or the public servant as a sort of a minister, whether that's a member of the clergy or a politician, and this sense that we are both serving, but in doing so, we place ourselves in a sort of special position, and there may actually be trappings around that position. And I wondered how we guard against the sense that, in addition to giving the public what we want, that they can only get to what they want through us, and sort of perpetuating ourselves as the exclusive ministers of their needs. And if in doing that we miss opportunities to notice when perhaps we are simply getting in the way.
I've always found it's very helpful to have people who know me, whether it's in a congregation or family or friends or whatever, who will say, come off it, Jane, that's a load of old codswallop. And to just prick the balloon. And I think all of us need people like that. Maybe people in public office, I include clergy, more than most. But we all need that and that reminder. There's a kind of parallel thing to do with in church terms. If you're reading the scriptures and you think, oh, I just agree with this, I agree with this, I agree with this, you're not really reading them. Okay? It's important that we're sometimes made to feel uncomfortable and reminded that we're as human as the rest of them, and that this is no guard against, it's no sense of privilege in the kind of way you were describing.
Well, I'd only say, as you were saying this, Jane, I had this recollection of having an extremely difficult telephone conversation with somebody when I was on them, actually in the shadow cabinet, trying to get them to do something they didn't want to do. And my daughter cottoning onto this conversation and the language I was using, and then starting to pull great Pinocchio nose and dancing round me while I was doing this. And I had to keep a straight face and also carry on this course. It wasn't, there was a noble purpose in what I was doing, which was trying to get someone to defect from the Liberal Democrats to the Labour Party and to announce this in advance of the election in which he was standing as a Liberal candidate. But anyway, and I was using words, but I felt sort of, I thought I deserved it at the end of it. There you are. And having people pull you down is sort of challenge you is really important. I think we've got time for... thank you. The capo here is telling me one more. So is there one more question? Yes, please, sir.
I'm a member of the House of Lords, and I've been a member of the European Parliament, amongst whom my constituents are both Jack Straw and Harold Shipman. Now, it struck me, and I was thinking back at what Jane was saying at the beginning, that is the breadth of what you were describing as public service, in fact, wide enough? If you are a very good businessman and you run an ethical business, if you run a builder and you build well and you don't overcharge, surely that is as much public service as some of the perhaps more rather obviously serving activities you described. And in the far corner of England I come from, I hope my obituary will include the words much respected, because that seems to be the litmus test of people who probably have led a life which would fall in the description of public service that you've given, perhaps a slightly narrower front.
Thank you for that, and I think I agree with you, actually. I didn't really develop that, but where the motive is not simply making as much money as possible for shareholders or something, but actually has other spin-offs or is engaged in work that's good and society building and all the rest of it, I would entirely agree with you, and maybe I'll give some more thought to that. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jane. I was reflecting on the triangular little triangle here between the lady who had worked for the Ministry of Justice for 43 years, the lady in front, who obviously worked as a magistrate, and Lord Inglewood, each of whom was using the word respect. And behind this series of lectures seems to me to be quite a sort of slightly pessimistic view about society, I just wanted to say this about the criminal justice system, because the criminal justice system has got much better because it treats people more with respect. And I started in practice as a young barrister over 40 years ago. Everybody knew within the system, no one admitted it too publicly, that suspects were routinely beaten up in the cells, that confessions were drafted for them and signed, that prisoners were not well treated in prison. They had buckets for lavatories, and they were called by their surnames. And representing youngsters who are in trouble was terrible. And the system has got much better. It does treat people with respect. And although you won't read this in almost any newspaper, because it's good news, not bad news, but the fact that crime has gone down, and crucially, that the number of young people coming into contact with the criminal justice system, and now the number of young people who have to be locked up, has dropped dramatically in recent years, is, I think, all sorts of reasons behind it, but it's because we've not taken a soft attitude to this, but we've taken a more civilised and respectful attitude to other human beings who happen to have fallen into trouble for whatever reason. So I just offer you that as a sort of rather hopeful thing about the fact that our society is not all going to the dogs because politicians are now below estate agents in the order of respect. But that's a long way around to say, Jane, thank you very much. You did put in a huge amount of effort into a brilliant lecture and then into answering the questions. And all of us here are very grateful indeed to you for doing so. Thank you very much.